Coming up, we have S. Barahini from The Athletic talking about Game 3 of the NBA Finals, what we're expecting going forward in the series, as well as the Giannis Antetokounmpo sweepstakes and guards in the 2026 NBA draft. And then later in the show, I got Kareem Lopez, a potential lottery pick in the 26th draft, talking about his journey all the way from Mexico to Spain, then to New Zealand, to the NBA. It's a fun conversation with Kareem. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're here to discuss Game 3 of the 2026 NBA Finals. A Spurs win in Madison Square Garden, 115-111. Joining me from The Athletic, Raptors Republic, S. Barahini. S, what's up, man?
Dude, I'm living the dream. First of all, thank you for having me, Kevin. What a game. It feels like we've had three great games, you know? Close encounters. The fourth quarters have been, like, the margins have been very, very thin. And we've seen both teams kind of throw their punches. San Antonio threw their punch in Game 3. I thought they made some really interesting adjustments that I'm sure we'll get into. But it was a great crowd, great atmosphere. It was my first game in Madison Square Garden. So to see that, live and up close, very, very cool. But it was a great game, man.
It was an awesome game. It was a lot of fun. We've had three really good games. I mean, this has been an A-plus series so far. It feels like we are headed towards a deeper series. We'll see. It's hard to predict, obviously. Knicks could blow them out in Game 4, and it could be a five-game gentleman's sweep. Who knows how it's going to result? But you mentioned the adjustments in this game. Game 3, number one thing that stuck out to me is the Spurs defense felt like they turned the Knicks into an ISO-heavy offense. There weren't as many of those beautiful driving kick sequences like we saw previously in the series for the Knicks. It was more stagnant. They were pressuring Brunson full court, getting the Knicks into their half-court offense later, switching on ball, very aggressive against Brunson. What did you see that slowed down that Knicks offense from the San Antonio defense in Game 3?
The first adjustment is the fact that they committed to putting Wembanyama on Josh Hart. You know, I think for stints in Game 1 and Game 2, we saw that they sprinkled in those moments where he was guarding Hart, sagging off of him into the paint. But this time, they just fully committed to it. I don't think we saw that much of Wemby on Karl-Anthony Towns, and that really unlocked the Knicks' driving game. He was able to attack closeouts. Obviously, Wemby being further away from the basket allowed the Knicks to be able to drive a little bit more. And so I think that was the biggest adjustment defensively that allowed the rest, to your point, be a little bit more isolation heavy. I mean, the Knicks were, 18 assists to 40 shots or 40 made shots. Comparing that to Game 2, where it was like 29, 30 assists to 38 made shots, it's such a massive difference to the style that the Knicks were able to play. I think that directly is, you know, a Karl-Anthony Towns thing, because Towns scored 11 points on 10 shots. It was definitely his quietest game of the finals offensively. I think a lot of that has to do with, one, the Spurs picking Stephon Castle to guard him, make things physical on him. The Spurs in general were very physical with Cat. And then the other side, camping out Wemby in the paint, making it so that if there are drives, they're going to be met by Wembanyama, and he's a little bit closer to the basket. He doesn't have to guard as much space, right? You remember that crazy play from Game 2 where they were springing back and forth, the drive kick, the beautiful game, Knicks.
Yes.
Yeah. That didn't happen in this game.
And the only time something even came close in Game 3 was that Wemby swatted Landry Shamet's shot into oblivion.
Which was incredible block. It's crazy to watch Wemby live in person, because you're like, oh, that's a wide open layup.
Yeah.
And it's no longer a wide open layup. It just disappears. It's incredible.
Remember in the first quarter, I think there was a moment where he deterred somebody from even attempting a shot at the rim, and then he blocked a three.
I forget who
it was on.
It
was like,
I think
the
it
first
was OG.
Three, 4 minutes of the game, blocked a three-pointer. I was like, okay, it's one of those Wemby nights. And I mean, you mentioned they had him on Hart more. That's true. Castle on Towns as well more often. Towns in the game. Game 1, 63 touches. Game 2, 64 touches. Game 3, 45 touches.
Yeah, that tracks.
And it felt like he was just invisible for many sequences of the entire night. Compared to Games 1 and 2, compared to this whole win streak for the Knicks, in which he's been a focal point. And I think the Knicks, to me, it felt like got away a little bit of handing the ball to Cat. It was a lot of Brunson dribble, dribble, dribble. It almost felt more like last year's Knicks that fell short. And with Jalen Brunson, I think it's partially what he had to do, given everything you're talking about with the adjustments. But also, it felt to me sometimes it was like a bit of hero ball. Like he was getting into things slowly, running the offense slowly, making slower decisions, just dribble, dribble, dribble over and over again. Did you feel that as well watching the game, or am I alone there?
Yeah, I wonder if it is by necessity. Because, look, at the end of the day, I was looking this up earlier, but Brunson is 30 of 81 in this series, shooting 37% from the field. I think the Spurs guards did a much better job in game three of containing him on those drives, not letting him get to the free throw line. I mean, look, we can get into the free throw stuff because Mike Brown was clearly not happy about that after game three. But ultimately, I think a lot of that has to do with the Knicks not being able to hit their shots. Like Landry Shamet was 1 of 7 in this game. They didn't get the ancillary guys knocking down their shots. Of course, a great OG Anunoby game, but you don't have Bridges knocking down his shots. Hart is a guy that the Spurs defense is willing to live with knocking down those threes. Cat wasn't able to knock down in space. And so the spacing was a little bit tighter for Brunson to attack. I do agree that's a crutch for them. When things aren't going their way, when that secondary pass doesn't lead to a shot, it ends up being Brunson. Okay, I'm going to be the hero for this one. He struggled in this series. And to the point about Kat earlier, the Knicks are at their best when Karl Anthony Towns is their best player. Yeah. You know,
he's the MVP.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as shade. Like
Brunson was trying to be trying the MVP to win, in game three. Maybe it wasn't intentional or anything, but that's what it felt like watching a game where it's like, oh, this is a guy
shoot his way out
of take
it.
His award back.
Right. Hey, maybe, you know what? I don't know, but I do think like stylistically, the Knicks are just at their best when Karl Anthony Towns is their best player. And I understand how important Jalen Brunson is to this team. He's hit two massive shots in game one and game two that iced those games for them. But at the end of the day, like the stylistic difference between a Karl Anthony Towns led team and a Jalen Brunson team is clearly different, you know, and it's a difference maker, especially against this Spurs team where like you don't necessarily have the bigs to contain Cat in the way that the Spurs want to. Wemby's obviously there, but it's a tough matchup for him.
I was just seeing a quote on screen, a quote card from Stephen A. Stephen A. said similar to what I just did.
Oh,
I didn't even see that.
Oh, did he?
That's either a good thing or a bad thing,
pull
depending on your perception.
There you go.
It looks like he was planning to be an MVP rather than playing. That's a good take. Good take. I did not even see that.
It's a good take.
I didn't even see that. Nice. I went straight to bed, woke up, did pod prep this morning. speaking of Brunson, though, I have some stats for you. This is what I was putting my time into this morning. Yeah. So Brunson continues to struggle in the Wemby lineups. For the series, this is crazy. He has scored 65 points with Wemby on the floor on 22 of 66 field goals, 39% effective field goal percentage. With Wemby off the floor, Brunson has scored 17 points on 8 of 15, 53% effective field goal, which is basically equivalent to his numbers efficiency-wise during the regular season. So we're seeing what we've seen throughout the playoffs, where Wemby on court is causing opposing star ball handlers to see their efficiency plummet. It happening at SGA last round, forcing him out of the paint. It's happening against Brunson. I think it's a little different with Brunson, though, because Brunson is normally a highly efficient perimeter player on mid-range jumpers and three-point jumpers. Part of it, I think, is what Castle and the guards are doing or able to do against Brunson when Wemby's on the floor. But the bottom line is, you see these numbers on screen, this is not going to cut it for the Knicks in the series. They win the first two games, but ultimately, Jalen Brunson needs to be more like in that right category, Brunson with Wemby off the floor. He needs to be more efficient, or else this could be a series that swings heavily back into the Spurs' favor.
It's fascinating to see that because it's like 66 shots. Obviously, Wemby's on the floor for a longer
far
amount of time.
Far majority of them.
Than he is off.
Yep.
It's also like, I don't know how you feel, but every time Jalen Brunson runs a pick and roll with Mitchell Robinson, good things happen. You know, I think even against Wemby, Mitch has found ways to seal Wemby off in those driving lanes, get Brunson a couple
screens,
a little Gortat
stuff.
Screen,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Get him some easier looks. We actually saw that in game three a couple times when it was Brunson and Mitch. I wonder if that's a counter. Like, just have those guys paired together more often.
More Mitchell Robinson. Even though we saw him less in game three.
Yeah.
We saw small ball.
Yes, we saw smaller. Well, so, I think they were trying to juice the three-point shooting and passing.
I think so, too.
But I think they should be playing more Mitchell Robinson, especially because now the Spurs have countered, right? Their defensive adjustments are clear. it's like, what are the solutions that we have? I think it is more Mitchell Robinson.
It very well
Robinson also has played good defense on Wemby. Like, one-on-one has done a good job of containing.
He has. And I mean, I think that's the interesting push-pull for, for Mike Brown, because on one hand, I think you're right. Good things seem to happen more so for Jalen Brunson and pick and roll with Mitchell Robinson.
Yeah.
But also, he is a hackable threat that can totally ruin the flow of your
hackable.
Offense.
I love that. He is.
I think it's a tough balance. And also, Karl Anthony Towns, you want to play him as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Small ball did get them the lead in the second quarter, too. So maybe there is something to small ball.
Yeah.
But it did feel like the small ball did run out of a little juice, which is what tends to happen against bigger front lines. But ultimately, I mean, for Jalen Brunson, he needs to be straight up better. And I thought with Victor Wembanyama, he was better in this game. And that was in part the way the Spurs adjusted with him. Game one, he took 21 total shots in the game. 9 of them were threes. 6 came in the paint. Game two, 21 total shots. 6 were threes. 11 came in the paint. Game three, he had 18 total shots. Only 4 threes.
Yep.
And 13 of them came in the paint. So 13 of his 18 shots came in the paint in game three. And by game, his first two games,
shot distance
was closer. Assisted opportunities, he was 10 of his 21 shots in games one and game two were assisted opportunities. In game three, 14 of the 18 shots were assisted opportunities. So they've realized Karl Anthony Towns has this guy under control, one-on-one, self-created chances. We're going to find ways to get him buckets at the rim with assisted chances.
It was... I honestly think it had to do with Wemby's level of aggression. In the pick and roll with De'Aaron Fox and with Steph Castle, it wasn't about him popping out more. It was rolling and really making the Knicks have to tag him. And those tags, like, they came, but he kind of found ways over top of it. Like, he had a couple of lobs where even through traffic, he was just able to get a hand up and dunk the ball. I agree with you. I saw that there was a tweet. Shout out to whoever tweeted this. But shot distance was a big thing. So in game one and game two, it was, I believe, 17 feet in game one, 16 feet in game two. In game three, 10 feet in terms of shot distance. So they're getting him closer. You talked about the assisted points. You look at just shots in the restricted area between Castle, Wemby, and Harper. They had 32 of the Spurs 40 points in the restricted area. And 40 points in the restricted area is good. Like, the paint battle was pretty split, but in terms of restricted area points, which is points at the basket, the Spurs absolutely dominated. Part of that is Wemby. Also, I think the trickle-down effect of that is the Spurs guards were able to get downhill more often because of Wemby's gravity. We talked about the Gortat screens with Brunson and Mitchell. It has a similar effect where now, okay, Castle can kind of snake the pick and roll. He can use Wemby's gravity and finish at the basket. And Castle had an incredible game too with the driving, the and ones, really showed his aggression. So that's the way the Spurs offense is at its best, is when Wemby is aggressive. Now your guards are able to be aggressive, and it creates this trickle down effect for an actual good offense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's spot on. And ultimately, I think for Wemby, you mentioned the aggression aspect. He had two dunks basically in the opening yep. 2-3 minutes. And it was like, oh, wow, the throw the ball up to the
Game one versus OKC, right?
Yeah,
most of his buckets were in that restricted area. Yeah, yes. Of course, he hit that crazy shot at the end of the game. But a lot of what you saw from him was, hey, I'm going to force the issue. I'm going to make the refs make the calls. How many free throws did he end up having? He had 9 free throws in that game. Part of that is just being more aggressive. Part of that is making the referees actually make the call.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, obviously, Wemby is an elite free throw shooter. That sure helps out in those fourth quarters as well. I think with Wemby, it's interesting early in that game, the throw it up to the tall guy strategy. We saw that late, too. I mean, you see the play he had where, like, I think it was Fox threw him a kind of a lob in the lane. He kind of guided it in, Wilt Chamberlain style.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, oh, my God. That made me freak out. I'm like, this guy is nuts.
It's also, again, back to the defense. Like, on offense, watching this guy doesn't make sense. You're like, oh, that's going out of bounds. No, it's not going out of bounds. He caught the ball.
Literally nobody else can get there.
It's impossible. And it doesn't make sense how absurd he is until you watch him live.
So crazy.
Even from our perching angle of being a million feet away, you can actually see it a little bit better. Just his size advantage compared to everybody else. That's what... Look, again, I keep coming back to this, but maybe more Mitchell Robinson, because again, this is a 7-footer who can contest some of those lob opportunities, some of those ducking opportunities. I feel like that's the solution for the Knicks.
It's interesting. I mean, we saw the Knicks go small.
I know.
In game three.
I know.
But yeah. I do, like, in the back of my mind, I'm wondering, could we see them go too big?
Right. Yeah.
They, you know what I mean?
You know what's crazy? I did a video about the Knicks before the playoffs, mm-hmm. and a lot of their success in the regular season was actually with one of Cat yeah. or Robinson. It yes. wasn't with both of them.
They and so rarely ever do.
They both. Rarely yeah. go to those. I feel like that's not something that we'll see.
It I don't just, think so either. But yeah. it's still in the back of my mind.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair.
they have the card that can pull.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
If yeah. necessary.
And look, it's the finals. You're two wins away from a championship. You really only need to win one to be the commanding
sure.
team here. And it's at home. Mm-hmm. I feel like the shots need to fall. You need to play with better pace. This is the way that the Knicks got to win.
And yeah. I got to say with Wemby, like from a psychological perspective, he has this horrific turnover
mm-hmm.
at the end of game two, throwing it off the back of Stephon Castle.
The next day he's painting statues.
He's painting statues.
Beast.
In New York City with his sister.
Yeah.
And here he is, you know, game three bounces back. Mm-hmm. 32 points. 8-6 in the game.
Yeah.
He was outstanding on both ends of the floor, played truly a perfect game, his best game of the entire series. Got to give him a bit of credit there for bouncing back
Absolutely.
As a young player. And he did say, I'm built for this. He did seem built for this
yeah.
Entering game three.
I'll go even a step further. Most of this Spurs lineup outside of, I guess, you know, their big man and Luke Kornet has no finals experience.
Yeah.
You know, and all of those young guys answered in such a massive way. You talk about resilience. The fact that they lost their first two games at home coming into this crazy crowd in MSG and they were still focused and wired in, and you got the supplementary shot making of Devin Vassell. You got Julian Champagne knocking down a couple threes. Fox had a big shot in the fourth quarter. Obviously great games from Castle and Harper and Wembanyama. That young nucleus for the Spurs, they could have just given up. They could have said, the series is over, we're done, we don't have a chance here in MSG. Mm-hmm. And the way that they responded in game three shows you just how incredible of a team this is. I mean, they won 60 games in the regular season. They beat the defending champions. There's a reason that they're here. And I think we saw that in game three.
I think so as well. As you mentioned something earlier about the way the Spurs were operating on offense. Before we get to that, I just want to read a quick promo here. The all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. Make picks each round, earn points, and climb the leaderboard. You can play solo, create a private group with friends, join a public group to play with other fans, or even join our Yahoo Sports group to see if you can beat us. Join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. All right, S, you mentioned the Spurs offense. It felt like to me they were targeting Cat early in that game. You mentioned Castle, the aggression in those pick and rolls, just downhill, relentless attacks at Karl Anthony Towns early in that game. By the numbers, pick and rolls defended per game. This is either as the pick and roll ball handler or the pick and roll screener defender. Towns, 20 in game one, 28 in game two, 32 in game three. Brunson, 13 in game one, 13 in game two, 24 in game three. So they clearly, the Spurs that is, made a point to, we're just going to bring Brunson into pick and rolls as much as we can to wear him out, get him involved, and we're going to attack Towns downhill relentlessly with some tough, hard drives to the basket.
You're causing Knicks fans some trauma right now, because I've mentioned this before, but anytime you want to attack the Knicks, it's Brunson and Cat mm-hmm. in actions and put them in actions and try to get them into a blender. And Knicks fans are just so sad about it because there's no real solution to that, you know, outside of obviously, I think pinching in with OG and Bridges and Hart and having those guys help a lot in pick and roll situations. And truthfully, just hope that the ancillary guys, the role players for the Spurs aren't knocking down their shots. I think that's the biggest thing here. On top of that, I would say the pick and roll defense, particularly a lot of that had to do with them tagging Wemby. You know, because we saw in game one and game two, the amount of bodies that they were throwing at Wembanyama, just not letting him get into the paint, right? Brunson, who's 6'2" on a good day, was tagging him, pushing him out as soon as that roll was coming. And I feel like we didn't see that as much. I feel like we didn't see Hart or Ananobi or those guys being the aggressive tagger, making sure that Wemby isn't able to get into the paint or just limit his opportunities there. He got a lot easier opportunities getting those lobs. So that's probably the counter. The other thing is, when the Spurs are knocking down their shots, they're so much harder to guard. They were disguising a lot of weak side actions, you know, whether it was Champagne in that corner or Vassell in that corner, to make it a little bit easier for their pick and rolls to work. It was a lot of empty side stuff for Fox and Wembanyama, so there was a whole area of the floor that they could operate. It was just, I think it was just more proficient offense, you know? I think they had 122 half-court rating at some point in that game. It was because of their shot making. It was because the other guys were able to knock down their shots. And again, this is how NBA offenses work, man. Like, if there is one specific problem that a team can't take away, it starts to trickle down into everything else that you see. And when the Spurs are hitting their shots, when you can't guard the pick and roll, it becomes a tough night at the office for the Knicks defense.
Did you think this was going to be a sweep entering game three?
No, I did not. No, right. I thought
so weren't swayed.
There was no way that the Spurs were going to get swept. I thought it would have been insane if a team that won a seven-game series with the Thunder ended up getting swept by the Knicks. And look, I know the Knicks have had a dominant run, and that should be given credit. I mean, 13 straight wins, one of the best point differentials ever in that time. That's awesome. But this Spurs team is also awesome. And they find ways to answer. I think it's a level of resilience that both of these groups have. Now it's like, okay, the Knicks have been punched in the face. Let's see if they can counter.
Absolutely. I mean, especially their first loss since April 23rd.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do they bounce back after their first loss in nearly 2 months? That's kind of crazy.
That's crazy.
That's really nuts in the middle of the playoffs. Mike Brown, after the game, complained about the free throw disparity in the second half. 24 free throws for the Spurs to 8 for the Knicks. He said, I never thought, you know, I'd be in an NBA Finals and we'd be talking about free throw disparity in an NBA Finals game. I personally, didn't see it watching it live. I felt, to me, like there were a few extendee calls.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I just felt like the Spurs were the more aggressive, forceful, downhill attacking game. Whereas the Knicks, all the things we talked about, a bit more stagnant, not as much driving kick, not as much flow. I felt like it was more Spurs defense driven.
Yeah.
That said, in a game where Wemby, you know, tugged at Brunson's head, and we saw a Carter Bryant truck stick and a Stephon Castle truck stick.
Yeah.
I can understand why any Knicks fan would be feeling like, really, dude,
we're not calling
a flagrant for that on Wemby? Do you not want to get him suspended for a game? I can totally see that argument. But the 24-8 aspect, I don't have as much of an issue with. It's some of those other calls where I can see why Knicks fans are just furious this morning.
And I think, by the way, that's probably what Knicks fans are telling themselves about Jalen Brunson. Because one of the great things that Brunson can do is get to the free throw line. I know he still did in this game, but they probably wanted more. They probably wanted him to get to the free throw line more. And honestly, I think the Spurs' level of aggression, it's one of those things where they're like, we are going to foul every single time. So that the refs have to decide when they're going to call a foul. It's something the Thunder do incredibly well, but the Spurs do the same thing, which is we are going to be as aggressive as possible. We are going to force the officiating to dictate how this game is going to be played. And in game three, it was, you know, I do think it was in favor of San Antonio. Yeah, there were a couple of like touch fouls that ends up going one way or another, and that will flip a game. Ultimately, and I don't know how you feel about this, but one of the big things with officiating in the NBA is the consistency. You just don't know night in, night out, what kind of officiating you're going to get, whether it's the physicality and just assessing what kind of physicality will be allowed in any game. I mean, obviously, there was that one time you mentioned the truck stopping, but like Castle elbowing Brunson on the offensive foul. And I think they said it was nothing in that. But those are the type of calls I'm sure Knicks fans are looking at and saying, how are you not calling that?
I saw Wob post last night saying it's kind of like a no blood, no foul series.
It does feel like that.
It really does.
Yeah.
I personally am loving it. I love it a lot. I think you're combining the beauty of the nostalgic aspect of the 80s and 90s with the physicality and all that, with the modern day spacing and flow and passing and shooting. I find the blend to be unbelievable to watch.
Dude,
do you feel the same?
It's the best basketball that has ever been played, is my opinion. The level of physicality that we're seeing, the ground coverage that teams have to just cover spacing-wise. You think about the three-point era. Everybody talks about three-point shots, but it's also ground coverage for defenses. And we are seeing just from a Spurs perspective, from OKC's perspective, from the Knicks in these playoffs, some of the best defenses in the NBA. And the way that they are able to contain that amount of space, that's just something we've never seen in basketball. You go back and watch like 80s hoops, 90s hoops, the spacing and how much ground that had to be covered compared to now, it might be two times as much ground covered just because there's guys who are pulling up from half court. There's guys who are able to like attack closeouts consistently, drawing out the big man. I really do think it's the best basketball we've ever seen. And to your point about toughness and physicality, I think the NBA has taken that note over the last couple of years where they're allowing the physicality to be an element in the game. And of course that happens in the playoffs as well, where, you know, it, no blood, no foul.
I was texting with my buddy Phil, who works a job that is very, very busy. He's like one of those dudes that works like 18 hours a day.
Okay. And
he,
like, I'm so sorry, Phil.
And I mean, he loves what he does, but like he doesn't have like a lot of time to watch basketball during the season.
Yeah.
And he texted me, I think it was after game 6 or 7, one of the two of the Western Conference Finals. And he's like, this is the best basketball I've ever seen in my life.
It's awesome, man.
And like, he's somebody that's been a fan of the 90s and 2000s, a little bit older, and loves that era of basketball.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is the best it's ever been.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like that's the thing when I talk to some older fans who still watch the game, they're like, oh, it's better than it's ever been. But there is a nostalgia aspect that I understand.
Sure.
From past eras.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, those stars, by the way, in those eras would still do well in this era.
Of course.
I really think a lot of the skills are replicable. It's just
transferable to any era. Right? Absolutely. The greats truly
are able to do it whenever. I think that applies in honestly any sport. If you're great at it, you'll be able to play it in any era. But with basketball, you see the way that, again, ground coverage is a massive part of this. Three-point shooting is a great part of this. But also, the level of physicality that scores have to deal with now. We've talked about Brunson. We've talked about SGA, the sort of trickery, if you will, that they're able to go along with. That applies to a lot of players in the league now. They are able to dictate what the defense is giving them. I mean, I would wager, I don't know if this is necessarily true, but I would probably make the bet here that in terms of stars, they get blitzed and trapped and double teamed more often than they probably have ever. And so that has a trickle down effect to the amount of space that people are guarding too. So
I got some loose notes from last night's game.
Yeah, shoot me.
Number one on my list here is Spurs went with their all skill lineup at the end of the game, last 5 minutes. I mentioned this, I think it was after game two. I said, well, we see the three guards, Howard, Harper, Castle, Fox, with Wemby and Vassell. We did see that the last 4 minutes and 50 seconds of the game. They got outscored during that stretch, but they had played only 3 minutes together during the regular season and 1 minute together during the playoffs.
Yeah.
And they played 5 straight minutes to close the game. I'm intrigued by Mitch Johnson going to that lineup as his closing unit, because I think even though it got outscored, even though it felt like there was some plotting possessions offensively still, despite having all those ball handlers out there, I think there's something to that decision that he's made with having all those guys out there, in part because even though things did get kind of mucked up at times, we did also see Castle hit a big shot. Fox hit the clutch pull up, despite not having the best game.
Yeah.
He had that pull up. Just the points of attack from different areas of the floor with Vassell instead of Champagne and having the three guards out there. I think there's something to that that Mitch Johnson decided would be effective for the team. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see it even a little bit more moving forward in the series.
It's what the Knicks do well, which is have five guys on the floor that can make decisions, dribble, pass, shoot, right? And, you know, we talked about modern basketball, but that's sort of the way things are leading, which is you need to be able to make a decision on the floor. If you're a basketball player, if you're an NBA player, you have to make decisions now. And from the Spurs side of things, all of those guys that you mentioned can do that, you know? Having extra ball handling is a big factor here. It was a huge factor in the OKC series when, you know, the Thunder didn't have Jalen Williams, they didn't have AJ Mitchell, and the ball handling for the Spurs really allowed them to carve out an advantage. Now you can lean into that more against this Knicks team that, truthfully, I think those guys aren't bad defensively either. They're incredible defenders, so they can hold their own against bigger guys like OG and Josh Hart. That's probably the way to go. I wonder if the Spurs lean into that more often.
You said OG, 28 points, drives on Wemby, threes, played excellent defense. He had the sequence where he had a step back on Dylan Harper, and then he blocked Harper on the other end. I was like, this guy's possessed. How can they lose this game? The OG in an Obi night.
Yeah.
And they did lose it.
They did. That was the most Kawhi Leonard-esque I've ever seen him.
Oh my God.
You know, everybody talked about it. It was like, this guy's the next Kawhi.
Way to put it,
but he true. Was he yeah. that was the most Kawhi Leonard-esque he's ever been in his life.
Everything.
The pull-ups, he had the mid-range jumper going. He attacked closeouts. This guy, by the way, has no fear of Victor Wembanyama multiple times now in this series where he's attacked a closeout and tried to dunk right over him. That's the fearlessness of OG as a player. I think you know, back to what we were talking about with isolation basketball and a little bit of dribbling the air out of the ball, this isn't a knock on him because I think OG is an incredible player. He's one of my favorite players of all time. As you guys know, I cover the Raptors. But sometimes when OG has those big games, it tends to be the nights where the Knicks aren't moving the ball a lot. And the ball finds him. He's able to knock down his shots.
Bailout plays, right?
It's bailout plays. Mm. It's the ones where you don't necessarily have a great shot, but OG ends up being the guy to knock it down. It kept them in this. They were able to stay close, but I think that's a symptom of some of the issues that we were talking about.
I think it's a really good point. In part, I mean, like OG having to find the ball in his hands with 8 seconds left on the clock is because they're not getting
that.
Yes, yeah. They're not getting those early offense chances. You're not getting transition chances. And the Spurs barely turned the ball over in the game.
Mm-hmm.
It was only 8 turnovers to 13 for the Knicks. And you're not getting that. You're not getting driving kicks. You're not getting these second side opportunities or third side ball swinging sides. You're relying on OG to have to make a play at the end of the clock. And that isn't your ideal, even though tonight it worked and it did help keep them in the game. I mentioned the turnovers, like really straight out of the gates. Knicks had some really sloppy turnovers right away in the game. And like you look at it in the end, only 13 turnovers. It's not like they had 20 plus. But the turnovers they had led to 21 points off of turnovers for the Spurs. It felt like every time they coughed it up, the Spurs were going back the other way. And some of the turnovers were just
silly.
So sloppy.
Yeah,
like just passing it to wide open space. Nobody's standing there.
Even in the fourth quarter, there were a couple possessions where, you know, the Knicks got a stop. It was a couple points. I think it was like a 3 or 4 point game. They had a chance to either take the lead or tie. And they would dribble down the court and Brunson would kick it out to the corner and it'd be like, OG misses the pass or Hart is like trailing the play and isn't able to catch the ball. Very silly mistakes that actually seemed or it felt like game two for the Spurs, where the Spurs had all those turnovers with the pitch back passes, the cross court passes, the ill-advised stuff. I think that happens when you're trying to force it, when you're rushing things, when the Spurs defense is dictating the pace for you. And I mean, look, we saw that in game three. I think it was OG Anunoby post-game. He said it. He said we weren't on the same page. And I agree. They were not on the same page in game three.
We'll be right back. What was your experience getting into the arena last night? Because obviously there's a lot of talk about all the security, President Donald Trump in attendance, and everything was more locked down.
Yes, it was.
I will say it did seem like every seat was filled 20 to 30 minutes before. People did get in.
Yes.
The buzz before the game was amazing.
Absolutely.
Like, there was a real thrill. It was like, oh my God, this feels like the finals. Yeah. However, I'm curious about your personal experience getting in.
Honestly, it kind of surprised me that it filled out that way. I thought there was no way that the arena would be filled because of the lineups that we saw outside. So, I mean, kudos to the efficiency, I guess, of everything that was going on. For us personally, you know, I had a great experience getting yelled at by Secret Service because I was in the wrong lineup. But how many times can you say that, you know, getting yelled at by Secret Service?
You were in the wrong line?
I was in the wrong. There were two different media lines, and then we got into one, and we stayed in this, and they're like, you gotta go to the other one, get in there. I'm like, okay, all right, sounds good. It is what it is. But honestly, outside of the commotion and the lineup outside, getting in was fine. Finding your seats were perfectly fine. Everything else was fine. It worked out well. And to your point about how loud it was, I would put it up there as like one of the loudest arenas I've been in my life. I you know, obviously Toronto 2019 finals, that's probably still number one for me.
Yeah.
OKC in game one of last year's finals was very loud. That was probably second. You know, I think some San Antonio crowds in this series have been really loud in moments. This was a really, really loud crowd.
I still think the loudest crowd I ever was in was after Isaiah Thomas lost his sister. And he scored 40 something points.
That was a great game.
In the playoffs against the Wizards. I think I've been to a lot of loud games at TD Garden throughout my life since I was a little boy going to games with my dad.
Sure.
I think that was the loudest wow. decibel level hit.
That's a surprising one. I wouldn't have expected that.
Maybe it's just in my head because of the emotion of the night.
Yeah.
But I really do. I wonder if there's like some stats at TD Garden behind like what's the loudest decibel level, because there's something about that night.
Yeah, kind of curious.
Hit shot after shot after losing his sister and had surgery and all that. Like he was, incredible.
Okay, now that we're sharing stories, I think the loudest crowd that I was ever part of was 2014 Game 7 Raptors Nets. There was a moment where Deron Williams was at the free throw line and you could genuinely see the rim shaking, you know, and that those are the type of moments where you're like, man, like I might lose my hearing after this, you know, again, crowd pop in MSG was awesome.
Yeah.
But you know, hey, it is.
I always bring my earplugs that I use for concerts sometimes.
Listen, older folks like yourself. No,
well, I've had my tinnitus scares before.
Oh, really?
I had a tinnitus. I still do have tinnitus, but it's very subtle. It's not that noticeable.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I had my tinnitus scare like 10 years ago where like I could noticeably hear it ringing in my ears for like a month or two straight. And I was like, oh my God, is this going to be like this for the rest of my life? Yes, but it like kind of like the volume lowered.
Is it the worst when you're sitting down in bed or like lying down in bed and it's quiet?
It's the worst for me if I don't get enough sleep. If I don't get enough sleep, my tinnitus is always louder the next day. If I get my 7 to 8+ hours, I am good. It's not even noticeable at all. But it's very important to protect your ears. It is. A disclaimer for people.
I will say,
don't be young and dumb like me at concerts and wear the ring in your ears as a badge of honor,
right,
of toughness.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Bring earplugs and use them. Bring good ones. So it's like, you don't want to ruin the experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe sometimes twist them out a little bit for a good song and put them back in for a song you don't care about as much. But it's true.
Have you watched the movie Sound of Metal?
No, I haven't.
No? It's about a drummer who ends up going deaf. And so he deals with the ringing at first. God. And then he slowly starts to lose. It's one of the best movies of last 10 years. But I agree with you. One time that happened to me, I had a tinnitus scare as well. Salt Lake City. We were coming back and apparently because of the elevation or something like that, I had ringing in my ear. It was scary. And it was also one of those things where you're like, am I going to deal with this forever?
Yeah, it was scary.
Yeah, wear earplugs. A lot of older media members, you will see them put the earplugs in because they've dealt with it.
Another quick disclaimer, this is NBA Finals podcast, but very important. My mother has something called hyperacusis, which is like basically the volume is turned up to 12 for you all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like you can't go like busy restaurant, like
it's really cranked up.
You can't tolerate it. It was caused for her from an MRI. So if you ever get an MRI, you know how loud those are.
Yes.
Make sure your hearing protection is properly in.
Wow.
Or else that can
screw
you up.
Yeah.
So like take your hearing seriously.
Yeah.
Games, concerts, MRIs.
Yes, folks.
This
is brought to you by the Hearing Society of America.
Yes. If there's ever some technological advances to cure tinnitus or hyperacusis, that would be wonderful. But it is true. I mean, I do think for like going to games like that, like the loudness.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to games like I remember Houston, I excite this game all the time. Harden had like a 18 assists, 12 rebound game in like 2016, 2017. And that was like one of the best games I had ever seen in person.
Yeah.
It was actually against the Knicks, Rockets Knicks. And the crowd was dead for the game. And I remember sitting there like, wow, how thankful am I to have grown up a Celtics fan going to those games with loud crowds, even when the team was bad.
Yeah.
Never mind when my favorite player is having a historic night and the crowd is dead.
That's
and
crazy.
So it's like, I think there's some, I've been at Knicks games when the team was bad. This was my first time at a Knicks game when the team was great in the finals. The crowd was good when the Knicks sucked.
Yeah,
absolutely. When they were an ugly team, the crowd was good. I have been to Bulls games when the Bulls sucked. The Bulls always suck every time, as long as I've covered the league. The crowd is still great. You can feel the buzz in the arena. You can feel the buzz outside the arena. And you root for teams like that to do good. And so for the Knicks, I'm looking forward to seeing game 4 tomorrow to see what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I would imagine the vibe will be a little bit less confident after this game 3, because game 3, it's like Knicks in 4, sweep, right?
Yeah,
like, you're done, Wemby. They're booing him every time he steps out on the court. Game 4, it's going to be like, uh-oh. We got to win this one.
You got to win this one, because now you go to San Antonio if you're tied 2-2, and there's a chance the Spurs take the 3-2 lead, and you don't want to get into that conversation.
That's scary.
I would still, after everything that we've said, I would still favor the Knicks in this series. I think they have the solutions. They have the answers to what the Spurs can do. It's just about execution for them, you know, especially when it comes to Karl Anthony Towns. It's just about execution. It's just about that guy being the best player in the series. If he can do that for two more games, the Knicks will be NBA champions.
I think so too. I think so too. But that said, I didn't pick the Spurs in seven.
I picked the Spurs in six. So that's
okay,
fair.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think like everything that could have gone wrong for the Spurs for the first two games did go wrong.
And the margins were so close.
Yeah, but every game has been so close. Even the first game, 10-point game, it wasn't really
It got extended. Margin.
It was extended at the end. It was a close game. It's been an A+, 10 out of 10 series.
Absolutely.
For me personally so far. Like I could not wish for any more. Maybe you give it a 9.8 instead of a 10, you know, this or that. You can but
best finals since, I mean, last year's finals were incredible, actually, I'm thinking about it. But this
one's better than last year so far.
You think so?
I think so. I mean, these games have been amazing.
Yeah, but we got a 7-game series last year.
I know, we did get a 7-game series, but like the first three games.
I don't know, man.
I don't know.
No, I can't do it yet. We got a 7-game series last year.
I know, but first three games.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know, but... No. I'm going with last year's finals.
Last year's fine.
We'll see, though. I agree with you that it could go seven. And I mean, everything rides on game four. You know this so well. But game four of any playoff series is the best. That's the one that completely dictates the series. I wonder what the stats are on that, where like how many teams in a 2-1 situation end up going on to win the series if they win game four. Because... It really does feel like whoever wins game four for most of the playoff series that I've watched in my life ends up going on to win the series. So we'll see what happens.
I think it's going to be fascinating to see from the Knicks side of things if we're going to see any major adjustments here, because the losing team tends to always make adjustments like the Spurs did entering game three. But also I think for game four, will there just be a different type of vibe outside the arena, non-basketball?
Well, yeah, there won't be barricades. Will there be still?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. But ultimately, I think these finals, I think we're set up to go deep into the series.
Yeah.
Even after the two games, going into San Antonio, winning both, it's hard to fathom that actually happened. But there's something different about home court nowadays. Post-pandemic,
yeah,
home court isn't as powerful as it once was.
True. Yeah.
What do you think of the factors behind that, S?
I think teams are more experienced, and we talk about a Spurs team that isn't experienced, but teams don't let the road crowd get to them as much. I actually think the younger teams benefit more from that because they don't know any better. Like younger teams.
You think that's what it is?
I really do. Like, think about
how
often.
Young teams before.
Sure. But think about how often young players get like a phone forced into their face from when they were 12 years old.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's something psychological about upbringing.
I feel like it has to be because it's one of those things where they have been used to the attention from a camera point of view since they were like 10 years old.
And people in their mentions and their DMs telling them they suck, they're a loser, they're never going to make it.
They've dealt with Instagram
stuff.
Something
about that.
100%. And I actually think that helps younger teams now deal with the pressure a little bit better. Like we saw OKC last year. We're seeing San Antonio this year. I think there's a level to just young teams not knowing any better and being like, look, the pressure doesn't matter.
Or is it that they do know better? And that they come in more grizzled.
Right. I get
you know what
saying.
I mean? You know what I mean? Like it's because of their life experience. Or like this guy yelling at me from the second row.
Yeah.
It only like gives me more fuel. Well, it doesn't make me shake. Makes me more calm.
That's what Steph Castle was saying before the game yesterday. He was saying, like, man, the Wemby hoopla and everything that's happening right now, that kind of reminds me of my time in UConn.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a guy who's won a national championship. He knows exactly what it takes for the fanfare, the crowd, the atmosphere. I mean, those games can get crazy too. And so I don't think these guys get fazed by these moments. Wemby's a guy who played in the Olympics. You know,
all the U17, U18, U19, Olympics, Mets 92. He's coming second place.
Yeah.
Almost every time he's competed at the highest of stages, the biggest stages. So ultimately for him, he's like used to these stages as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something to that. But still, MSG is like a different level monster, but the Spurs seem completely unaffected by it.
Yeah, it's cool. That's why I'm fascinated for game four.
I know.
Because I think they showed a level of calmness and resilience throughout this series. Honestly, even when they've been losing in the first two games, it felt kind of weird how calm they were about the situation. It's like, hey, you just lost two games at home and Wemby's out here sketching in a park. It just, I think that shows you the type of calm, the type of like collective effort that they all have. Will be fascinating game four.
A spontaneous topic here that I didn't tell you we would discuss, but okay. It's just coming to mind. Before we were on the podcast, we were talking about how each of us both interviewed Bennett Sturts.
Yes.
Potential top 15, top 20 pick in the NBA draft, of Raptors target, potentially a number 19 as well. Jalen Brunson, tiny guard in this series. Knicks are in the finals with a guy who's been their MVP in Jalen Brunson. I'm curious about your general thoughts, if you've watched these playoffs, as whether pros and cons about size for guards and its importance, because there's a lot of small guards in that draft range of the 10 to 25 range.
Feels like it's all small guards.
Basically, 5 to 25, really. Yeah, it's a lot of small guards.
Like Acuff is a small guard.
LeBaron Fylon
is a small guard. Bennett Sturts is like 6'2"-ish, right?
Yep. But Michael Brown is like 6'3", 185 or something like that.
And then you get to like Christian Anderson, who's also small.
Very small.
Ibuka Okori is like 6'2"-ish. Mm-hmm. I'm curious because I think Jalen Brunson is the exception to the rule. I think Steph Curry is the exception to the rule. I think Allen Iverson was the exception to the rule. I made a video about this at The Athletic if you guys want to go check it out, but it was about how rare it is to see a guy like Jalen Brunson be as prolific of a scorer as he is, as deep in the playoffs as he is, when it comes to the rest of the league. You just don't see it as often. And especially when it comes to Brunson and his style of game, it matches what the playoffs want the most. I know he's struggling here in this series, but for the most part, he's been an incredible playoff scorer. Like basically for the four seasons that he's been in New York, he's basically averaging like 30 points per game. Only guys who do that, who've done that, 6'2" and shorter, Steph Curry, Allen Iverson, Isaiah Thomas. Like those, that's a very small group of players across 40 years of NBA basketball. So when you look at the draft guys, I'm kind of curious about how they survive in this league. I think every single guy, whether it's Christian Anderson, Okori, Acuff, whatever, Sturts, being small does not help you in the NBA anymore. I think Jalen Brunson is the exception to that rule. How can those guys become the exceptions? Because it, like Rob Dillingham struggled in this league. You know, he still kind of struggles in this league. It's very hard for smaller players.
Ups and downs, Reed Sheppard.
Reed Sheppard, sure. That's a great one too. Especially like not just short, but physically small, like weaker, right. 175 pounds, 180.
Phylon. Yeah. That's my concern with him. Phylon is incredibly skilled with the ball in his hands, made significant improvements his sophomore year at Alabama, improved his three-point shooting, improved his driving to the rim, improved literally everything across the board. He got better in the ways that you wanted LeBaron Phylon to get better.
Yeah.
But he's 175 pounds. Even Brunson, listed at 190. I'm not convinced Brunson's 190. Brunson's
I don't know,
beefy.
Dude. He has like,
he's strong.
Yeah, exactly.
Thick legs, thick upper body. Yeah. I think he's well over 200, like physically very strong.
Yes.
And that's why he's able to bump. You see him bumping sometimes on those Wemby rolls, and he's playing really
good. He's got tree trunks, dude. He's
no kidding.
He's got like
he's
massive
not 190
thighs.
Pounds.
No
Let's
shot.
Be serious here. Yeah. He weighs more than that. And he's just not listed that way.
Yeah.
So I think with some of these guys, like, can Phylon get to 200 plus? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And like that
Sturts, I mean, this is something interesting from the interview that I did, but Sturts was talking about how he eats like 8,000 calories a day. He's trying to bulk up in such a massive way. And sometimes that goes to hurt players. You know, I hope it doesn't for Sturts. He seems like a really good guy, but it's just one of those things where you also have to be careful not to bulk up too much to take away parts of your game. So much of guards right now, especially that draft class, is about speed and agility. Like Christian Anderson, his ability to like score, get to the hoop, a lot of that is his speed. A lot of that is his quickness. Do you bulk up too much? Does that take away parts of your game? I think it's a valid question to ask. And honestly, okay, I'll throw a question back at you. Which of these guards is like the safest pick?
I think Bennett Sturts is the safest.
Okay.
In part because, I mean, so I interviewed him on Saturday for my podcast. If people want to listen to my version, they should check out yours as well.
Just do a double header.
Double header. Bennett Sturts, right after listening to this. Yeah. Bennett Sturts. Yeah. I think Sturts is the safest in part because of the size aspect. He does have some strength to him to survive on defense, but he has just so many different layers. He can be an elite off-ball player as a shooter off the catch, as a cutter. He can be a potentially elite playmaker as just a straight facilitator, not as a scorer, but just like get the offense in flow. High assist to turnover ratio, great decision maker. if the shooting and the scoring translates, well, then we're talking about a guy who has suddenly a lot of layers to his game as a potential engine. And so I think with him, he just has so many different ways that he can contribute to the game. And there's a level of safety there with his experience level where he, you know, playing at, you know, D2 to Drake to then Iowa, every level he stepped up and maintained his elite level of play. I think Sturts is a guy I had ranked in my 20s. After my interview with him, I heard everything that I wanted to hear from Sturts in terms of like how he perceives himself as a player and the things he's building towards. And I followed up with a few executives around the league about that. And I'm like, Sturts has been really impressive in workouts, really impressive in interviews as well. So I'd say Sturts is the safest from that next group, the non-top 10 group. Filon, the weight aspect, I worry about. Christian Anderson, I worry about. He didn't do a lot of, like, outside of pick and roll. Like, he really needed a screen to create space. Who else is in that group?
Corey?
Corey's probably the higher upside guy, I'd say. Of that group.
That's the most intriguing of the bunch because he's also long. Yes, right?
50% of his shots at the rim, despite, you know, that Stanford offense.
Yeah.
I mean, the dude gets the bucket.
He does get to the hoop. Yeah.
Like, there's something with him.
Also, like, to your point about defense, I think his length will allow him to be at the very least like a pretty good off-ball defender. That's another guy I think I'm looking for Toronto. I would go big if I was the Raptors, you know, grab like a big or a wing. I really like Dalen Swain as a wing to throw in there, but if they went guard, I think Sturts or Okorie is the guy to go.
Swain, there's like also every year there's guys in the draft that don't shoot.
Yeah.
But they look like they could shoot. Like Swain is an 80%+ guy from the free throw line. He's got some touch in the paint.
Yeah, I think he shot like 35% from three last year, right?
I mean, so it's like a little bit of improvement after being a non-shooter as Xavier's first 2 years. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Is Swain going to end up being the steal of the draft?
Right.
Right? Yeah. Like if he goes to a team that has the right fix for his three-point mechanics and you know, off the catch, suddenly 6'7", 6'8", with long arms, defensive playmaker who was a elite isolation player last year.
Gets the hoop all the time.
Oh, my God, without a jumper.
Yeah.
Guys like that, I'm like, wait a minute. Are we overthinking it with Dalen Swain and some of these guys?
That's what happens every time around this time of the year, where like the draft coverage ends up being how can we poke and prod at basically everybody, you know? And I'm very curious to see what happens in this draft. Obviously, the top of the draft is stacked. We'll see who goes first. Do you feel like there will be any crazy surprises, upsides?
Look, I mean, it's so hard to predict.
Yeah.
It really is. I think these teams seem open to moves. Like I've heard, I think AJ DiBonsa is the favorite to go number one.
Yeah.
But I don't see any reason why the Wizards aren't going to listen.
I think, you know, Tom Haberstroh suggested it on your pod for OKC to go out and jump into the top four. Was that?
Yeah, it's hard for Cam Boozer. Yeah.
I would agree. I'm here to say that they should do it. They should try their, because look, the first round picks at some point, you got to cash in your chips. This is the year to cash in your chips. You've got 12, you got 17, you got a bunch of interesting assets to throw out and attach to those. Mm-hmm. I would try to get up there. Like, even if it wasn't for the Cam Boozer types, if you get like an Adai Mara,
achievable for sure.
I think so. Yeah.
Get to either, you know, 5, 6, 8.
Yeah.
I think those.
But you don't think top four is hard to get into.
I mean, ultimately, here's the thing. The big variable in this whole draft process, the whole offseason, is Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Right.
Giannis, if he is moved to one of these teams in the lottery, Atlanta at 8, Miami at 14.
Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry, 13 for Miami. Miami at 13, Atlanta at 8. Some of these teams, Warriors at 11. My feeling from talking to teams around the league is that the Bucks are putting out there that they think they'll have multiple lottery picks. Mm. That might be just them trying to get as many prospects in as possible to schedule people. Oh, we're going to have multiple lottery picks. Come on in, right? Yeah. Like come to Milwaukee and you know, work out for us. It might just be that, but it could also be that they have some stuff on the table for Giannis Antetokounmpo that is acceptable.
Yeah.
And that they're just waiting to drive up the price as much as possible. But like there's teams in the lottery that are intriguing.
Yeah.
Like you could make the argument for Atlanta at eight.
Absolutely.
To put on both of their first round draft picks. I think Miami, the argument's obvious
that
they could put on the table. You could argue for Charlotte at 14, right? Imagine.
You know what? I've heard the Miami offer. I don't love the Miami offer. Like, yeah, I get it. They have 13, but the prospects don't intrigue me in the way some of these other prospects do. Like, of course, Tyler Herro is an intriguing player, but you have to extend him. Ware is an intriguing player, but has shown like very highs, very, very big highs and very, very low lows. And then Hawkes is like a good rotation player. I think if I were the Bucks, I would try to swing for getting the best blue chip prospect possible. Is that out there? Is that available? I think that's a fair question to ask. But let's say the Cavs were willing to include Evan Mobley. Would you rather the Heat offer, or would you rather Evan Mobley?
I don't want either of those offers.
Wow,
I'm not a Mobley guy. I've never been.
No,
a Mobley
but fair.
Believer.
But like, just from a value perspective,
nah, I don't want Mobley.
Who do you want then?
I don't want Mobley. I don't want Mobley.
Okay, fair enough. But okay, I don't know. Chet Holmgren, I guess.
I'd rather have Chet than Mobley.
I would agree.
I think Chet's got a little bit more offensive skill. Granted, what we saw in the postseason does not help that argument one bit at all. It doesn't help.
I'm trying to think like what other blue chip prospect would be available for Giannis. You know, I don't think there is one? I don't know.
Is there one?
I don't think so. Yeah. Maybe like Anthony Black. I don't even know. If
that's
he's not blue chip.
I don't know what's underneath.
What
blue
do you
chip.
Consider?
Like, what's underneath blue
chip?
Right?
Yeah, yeah, white chip. I don't know what it is really.
No idea. But like, I think picks heavy package with some flexible salaries, quality players in return. Like to me, that's what I'd be looking for from the Bucks. I don't know if they're going to get that blue chip prospect. Like, is Paolo Banchero a blue chip prospect? Probably.
Yeah, but he's not available. Yeah,
probably not. Yeah, sure. But even then, I don't know if I'd rather that than a very picks-heavy package with movable pieces. Because I think for Milwaukee, obviously you want everything. You want all of the above. But if Atlanta's making an offer for Giannis Antetokounmpo, are they putting Jalen Johnson on the team?
No, they're not.
So it's Risa Shea and parts.
Yeah,
right?
Ace Newell.
If Charlotte's putting a deal on the table, they're not putting Brandon Miller, Con Knipple, or anything. Like, speaking hypothetically, they're putting Miles Bridges and Grant Williams and like Trey Mann, those salary
And
deals.
Then all the picks, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's what's on the table. If it's Miami, Tyler Hero's not a blue chip prospect. Yeah. If it's the Warriors, that doesn't exist in the organization. Right. They're just giving all the picks. Jimmy Butler expiring salary. And I mean, who else could even make an offer?
Dallas? Maybe. They're not putting Cooper Flagg, obviously.
Exactly.
But
so there's no blue chip to offer. So I think for of those teams, I don't see the blue chip prospect. I think it's picks heavy. The blue chip prospect is the pick.
Right.
Because of this year's draft class being as strong as it is.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bucks already have the 10th pick. If they also get 8 or 13, whatever the pick is, that's two blue chip prospects.
And then that is it. Honestly, you can also try to move up from there. Like,
exactly.
If the Clippers, you know, I feel like the Clippers are a very, very good candidate to try and trade down. Yes. There's so many guards and wings and whatever that they can draft from 5 to whatever. So if you're the Bucks and you get 8 and 10 or 8 and whatever, you can move up. You can get to 5. You can get another, again, blue chip prospect, if you will. I think that would be nice. Also, can I just say, outside of the draft stuff, Minnesota should be the team that trades for Giannis. Feel like that is
where are the pieces though?
Okay, you talk about getting good guys and flipping them. I feel like Randall and Gobert are good guys to grab and flip.
I don't want Randall.
You can't flip.
Who wants Julius Randle?
The flip. The flip is available.
Wants Randall?
It's
if
like
I'm a
the
bad
Wizards.
Team, I don't want Randall. If I'm a good team, I don't want Randall. If I'm a mid team, a dumb franchise, maybe I want.
Maybe
Randall.
The Sacramento Kings. Yeah, you know? It feels like they're always the team. Yeah,
I threw you the LU, Bess. You're the one who said it. You're the one who said it.
Look, it is what it is. Also, I will say lottery reform. I feel like lottery reform has changed the value of first round picks, but also how willing teams are to trade them. So if you are going pick heavy on the packages, I'm kind of curious whether that will be the case for Giannis. You know, if someone's willing to include a pick in 2027 or 2028 and 2029. I know the drafts aren't as good, but because of those flattened lottery odds, it might be risky.
You never know. The drafts aren't as good, but like they could get better.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Players
yeah.
improve.
Yeah.
But I think to your point, that is the fear. Well, there's fear in dealing any pick now because there's so much randomness in 27, 28, and 29.
Exactly.
And then there's an unknown about what's going to happen 30 and beyond.
Yeah, yeah.
Next decade, because we don't know what the lottery system is going to look like.
It's insane.
Clearly, there's risk in dealing future picks because the NBA willy-nilly can decide retroactively and arbitrarily to change a rule that 3 months after the Grizzlies trade for an unprotected first-round pick, that pick can suddenly have an effective top five protection on it. So clearly, the precedent has been set. the legal change rules without regard to what past picks have been dealt. So that's why I think there's some fear in front offices to deal picks 2030 and beyond. But maybe that's more reason.
I think that hurts Giannis trade packages.
You think though. So?
I think that will. I don't think we will see that surplus Mikal Bridges for five picks type of thing ever again. I just do not see that type of thing happening. I know Giannis is obviously a much, much better player than Mikal, but I think the market has kind of evened out here, if you will, maybe in terms of trades.
What if a team is like, you know what, screw it. Like,
throw the chips.
We're not going to be in the lottery.
Well, the Toronto Raptors. <I'm just kidding.
laughs> Hey, why not?
They do seem like a team that would be willing to do that.
I would have said that more strongly if Masai were still there.
Yeah.
Because Masai, the Giannis connection. Absolutely. But ultimately, I mean, here's the thing though. Like, we just threw out a bunch of hypothetical teams for Giannis.
Yeah.
Only in the lottery, never mind non lottery teams.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think there's a lot of teams that you can make an argument should trade for Giannis. We didn't even non-lottery teams. Boston. I think Boston should be putting Jaylen Brown on the table for Giannis and the Kumpo.
I would agree.
Trade Jaylen to New Orleans or Atlanta. Try to bring in Giannis.
He'd be a perfect fit next to Tatum, man.
I
would
agree.
Be awesome.
Truly.
Also, the two teams in the finals right now. Like, maybe there's an opportunity.
That's crazy.
In New York, they have talked about Giannis ad nauseum, you know, and I know Giannis clearly wants to play in New York. It's one of those places where he listed as a destination. San Antonio, can you imagine a combination of him and Victor Wembanyama? That would be insane. They could cash in on those two. I wouldn't put it out of question that these two teams could make a run for him too. Why not?
Be crazy to be in the finals and then
flip Giannis. Flip for Giannis. Giannis. We saw the Warriors do it with KD, you know? Like a little bit different situation, but yeah.
Well,
let's say this. Okay, so the Warriors did it after they lost in 2016, and in a horrific way. What if the Knicks lost? Blow a 2-0 lead, yeah. And then go for Giannis. I don't know. It's just
they could blow a 2-0 lead, and they might go up 3-1. And who knows if they right. were? If they were to blow a 3-1 lead, 3-1
lead.
Say that's what happens.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, Knicks fans. Like, you turn.
That'd
off
be terrible.
Ball.
I'm hoping. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I feel horrible for you. But, like, if that were to happen. I think you would ask serious questions.
Very similar.
Yeah, you'd ask real questions. The KD thing was different, though. It was the cap spike. KD traitor to OKC. I still, to this day, yes, I got issues with that.
I agree.
I can't fathom your team losing 3-1.
Yeah.
And then going to the team that beat you.
Yep.
I can't fathom doing that.
Yeah, I saw a great tweet about this, but during the OKC San Antonio series, it would be like if, you know, Shea was like, I'm going to go and play for the San Antonio Spurs now. Like, that's how bizarre of a situation that was.
It's just, I can't fathom it. Look, I mean, who knows how differently KD's career would have went. He took a meeting in the Hamptons with the Boston Celtics. And Tom Brady was there. I thought he should have went to Boston. I think he should have went to Boston. And maybe things would have, he never would have won
the
title.
Did the Celtics win the chip?
Well, that's the thing. Maybe he never wins a title and things flame out in Boston and he's ringless to this day. But maybe he's still with Boston and he's got three rings and his jersey's going to be in the rafters. I don't know. Like, it's a sliding doors moment for Kevin Durant in his life. I just think joining the Warriors, yes, it was your best chance to win a title, but it was also the situation where you knew people would say you're joining a 73-win team that just beat you.
Yep.
You knew there was really no winning in that situation either. And I think he should have chosen Boston.
They went on a 15-game win streak. We talked about it with the Knicks and going on that 13-game win streak. The team that holds the record with Mike Brown. The team that holds the record is that 2017 Warriors team with KD, with Steph, with those guys. They were unbeatable. One of the best teams ever. Genuinely could go toe-to-toe with any team. And it's because Kevin Durant did that.
You can't blame him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, it is what it is, man. He knew he took advantage of an opportunity. Shout out to you, KD. Easy money, man.
I know. You can't blame him. But at the same time, I can blame him.
Yeah.
Not what I would have done.
Well, I mean, he's in a situation right now in Houston where it's like, what's next? Giannis, maybe that's another Giannis destination.
Yeah, exactly. We're just throwing out all these teams. It's like, oh, they should be a Giannis team. They should be a Giannis team.
28 or 29 teams should be interested in
Pretty
Giannis.
Pretty much. And that's the thing. Even though he's older, even though he's over 30, even though he's expensive, even though he's very whiny this past year, dealing poorly with a breakup,
yeah,
he's still Giannis Antetokounmpo. He has a chance to be one of the 10 to 15 greatest players in the history Absolutely. of the game and is 2 years removed from being top two, top three in MVP voting.
For seven straight years, by the
way. No kidding, right?
You know, like at that, I think that goes lost on people. This is a guy who averages 30, 10, and 5 for like the last 7 years of his career. By the way, the injuries are a valid point, but I also wonder if what the next step of Giannis's career is, like that second half of his career. I've always likened Giannis to KG, where KG, when he was in Minnesota, was more of like a wing slash power forward. He transitioned into becoming a full-time center. I don't know if that necessarily happens for Giannis, but there is a transition to be had into the late, not late stage, but like the second half of your career. What does that look like for Giannis? Because he's not driving the ball as much as he did when he was younger. He's taking more mid-range shots. His game has evolved to be a little less bruising. What does that look like going to another team?
Well, you know? It's interesting. I had Drew Hanlon, the NBA skills coach, on my podcast. I think it was early this year. Maybe it was last year. Maybe both years. I don't know. One of those years, Drew said to me on the podcast, he said Giannis came to him about wanting to improve his shot in part because of the desire to be less of a bruiser over the long haul of the regular season, knowing that he needed to adapt and conserve energy for the playoffs. He had gotten hurt in consecutive postseasons. He's like, I need to stay healthy for April, May, and June. I think this is a Giannis-driven decision to be less of a bruiser during the full regular season. And so with that said, I'd imagine that he'd be open to being kind of more of that second guy on a team with a primary.
We saw, I mean, I saw a report, Jake Fisher reported this, that he's not open to being the second fiddle to Steph Curry.
Which is so fascinating.
Yeah.
Because is it just a Warriors thing?
Is it something else?
Is it a Western Conference thing? That's been reported as well, that Giannis doesn't want to be in the West. He wants to be in the East.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm sure there's other factors involved there, but not being second fiddle to Curry, is that more of a, I don't want to be in the Steve Kerr offense thing?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree with his Western Conference thing. Avoid the West as much as possible.
Sure.
You know, especially with OKC and San Antonio. Why would you?
Well, you want to know what I heard? Like, this kind of relates to what you just mentioned there, like the being second fiddle to Curry thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're second fiddle to Curry, Curry is Curry. It's his team. Yep. He is the franchise. He's going to be
kind of the KD situation.
With the biggest statue, right? Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of the KD thing. I've heard that Giannis would love to be in kind of a historic franchise.
Mm.
You know, he did it. He led a small market franchise that never won anything in recent decades to an NBA Finals. I've heard that he would like to be on a historic franchise, which I'm sure is part of the appeal with the Knicks.
Yeah.
If you're the guy who comes to New York and leads the team to their
championship,
first finals.
Yeah.
If you go to Boston, a team like that, these historic franchises, I don't know if Miami counts as that. They've had so much success for multiple decades. Maybe they're becoming that, right?
Yeah.
And maybe Giannis can help them reach that level for the next X amount of decades. They are that team.
Yeah.
So
you're missing a team here.
Who am I missing?
The Lakers.
Well, yeah.
Historic franchise. Yeah, but like, you know, the Austin Reeves trade thing, I could think of a Luka Giannis situation. This is what I'll liken it to. In 1999, the Spurs made it to the finals. They beat the Knicks. Obviously, everybody remembers the Tim Duncan coming out party. He was awesome. He was incredible. Became arguably one of the best players in the league almost immediately once he came into the league. After 1999, it was Lakers 2000, Lakers 2001, Lakers 2002. Why? The combination of Kobe and Shaq. Mm-hmm. Luka and Giannis in LA. Yeah. I don't know. I'm planting the seeds here. I'm storytelling, baby.
I'm with you, man. I think there should be appeal there, even though the fit's not perfect. I think there's something special about what those two could do together.
Yeah, yeah.
Two high IQ players. They can figure it out.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Figure out and go win. S. Thank you so much for joining me today, man. Finals talk, draft talk, Giannis talk.
We did it all. Fun, man. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you so much to S. Barahini for joining me. Check him out at The Athletic and Raptors Republic. We'll be back again later tonight or tomorrow. I got another podcast coming, more NBA Finals coverage and a lot else. All right. Thank you to S. Barahini for joining me. Coming up, we got Kareem Lopez talking about his journey to the NBA. All right, now joining me is NBA draft prospect in 2026, Kareem Lopez. Kareem, how are you, man?
Good, man. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. You know, excited to be here. I'm doing great right now. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. So I think with you, it's interesting because you're a projected lottery pick, but a lot of people just watch college basketball. They're like, Kareem Lopez, that's not a name I'm familiar with. So for those people who have never seen you play, what's the Kareem Lopez scouting report?
Scouting report? Okay. You know, I'm a wing. I play, you know, small forward, power forward, or whatever. I think I play a lot of positions. I feel like, you know, very versatile on the court. You know, I'm an athletic player that can play above the rim. You know, a player that can, you know, pass. You know, a very all-around player, obviously, you know. A lot of things to get better at, but, you know, I feel like I'm a good player overall, you know, across the board. And, yeah, just a fun player, I would say, a winning player.
I mean, I think you described yourself well there because you are an all-around player. You have just so many different skills across the board. You're 6'8", 7-foot wingspan, 222 pounds. You measured in and at the combine as well. So you have size for the NBA coming in right now, even as a 19-year-old rookie. And I think that's one of the qualities that's impressive about you as well. And the funny thing is there might be some segment of fans that are familiar with the fact that you've actually played against the NBA before. I remember in 2014 preseason game against Utah, you had 13 points, 7 boards, 3 assists, 2 steals, 1 block at 17 years old. And that 1 block was on a Walker Kessler dunk attempt. You grabbed the rebound opportunity, ran the break for a layup going back the other way. That showed off the two-way ability. What do you remember from that specific sequence in that game?
Yeah, well, you know, I remember, you know, that was a great game, you know, great opportunity playing in an NBA court for the first time. I was only 17. That play was fun. You know, I feel like I showcased a lot of, you know, what I can do. I showed the world, you know, who I am. I'm a player, you know, can play both ways, both sides of the court, you know, getting that block on a big man, you know, taking the ball and just going in transition, you know, using my ball handling ability, my ability, you know, to get on the break, and yeah, using my athleticism too to finish the play. It was fun. It was fun.
You were born in Mexico, right? How old were you when you left to play in Spain?
Yeah, I was born and raised there. You know, I moved when I was 14.
Did your family go with you too, or is that just like a solo adventure at 14 years old?
It was a solo adventure. It was, you know, a challenge that I wanted to do. And yeah, I think it was great.
I mean, I can't fathom what it was like being 14 years old moving to a new country. I lived at home until I was 27. I didn't even live on a college campus. Total opposite experience of you until I totally left the nest. I mean, it's kind of crazy that happened. I mean, what was the conversations like with your parents at that young age when deciding to leave home?
Yeah, it was a challenge for sure. And it was, you know, not just for me, but also for my family, especially, you know, my mom. You know, she was like the one that was kind of like the most hesitant. You know, she didn't want to let her baby just go at 14 years old to a whole different continent and, you know, by himself. But, you know, it was an opportunity. It was to just follow my dreams, right? It's an opportunity to just, you know, get better, and it's something I really wanted to do. My dad understood that, you know, and my mom ended up understanding that, right? So, you know, it was a process, but, you know, at the end, you know, they figured, you know, it's what I wanted to do and it's what I needed to do. So, you know, they let me go, and I think it was the right decision by my parents right there. Props to them.
You mentioned that dream. Was that dream at the time the NBA? And if so, when did that dream to make the league first kind of spark in you?
Yeah, absolutely. The dream, you know, has always been to make the NBA since I can remember, honestly. You know, since I'm a baby, probably, since I have use of my brain, right? So, yeah, my dad used to play. My dad used to play pro in Mexico, play with the national team. So, you know, that's how I kind of got into basketball. And ever since I was really young, you know, watched the NBA. You know, like every hooper in the world, you know, dream about making it one day. So, yeah, that's when it started.
Now, that decision to go to Spain, obviously it set you on a path to where you are today as a potential lottery pick in this year's draft. How did it help growing up in that Spanish system that's produced a lot of, you know, NBA level talent, international level talent as well?
I would say it helped a lot. you know, it helped a lot in lots of different ways. First of all, I'll start with like off the court, I'll say, you know, moving into a different country, a different place by myself, you know, not having my family. Like it made me mature way quicker. You know, it made me, you know, see the real world, see what it is about. And, you know, live things that, you know, many 14-year-olds don't live. So I would say, you know, that also helped, like, on the court, right? And then, you know, the system, the European style, you know, it's different to the NBA, right? More tactical, more like half court, you know, more of a half court game or more set plays. So, you know, it's about expanding and, you know, adapting, learning. It was a learning experience for me. I learned a lot, you know, about basketball, learned a lot about myself, you know, and I feel like I grew in lots of different ways. You know, I feel like my IQ improved. I feel like, you know, it's a big part of my game. And it's a thing that really like helped in my development. And, you know, also I was playing against older people, you know, since I can remember. So it was really good for me, you know, just getting that experience, getting, you know, to play against better players, stronger, faster, better than you. You know, it makes you adapt. It makes you, you know, want to get better and makes you, you know, more hungry to just get to that level.
I mentioned earlier that game you played against the NBA team, the Utah Jazz. That's when you were in Australia, or with the New Zealand Breakers, rather, in the Australian League. And you spent 2 years there with the Breakers. For you, what was the biggest difference between year one and year two with the New Zealand Breakers?
Yeah, I would say going into year one with the Breakers, you know, I didn't necessarily knew what to expect. You know, you're going into a whole new environment. You go in, you know, as a 17-year-old kid, I was, you know, super skinny, going against people that are 30, people that are, you know, have been playing the game for, having pros for 10 plus years. So, you know, just at first I was just trying to adapt, but I knew in the back of my mind, and I really always knew that, you know, I was ready for it and I was going to, you know, make an impact and I was going to be good in there. And I feel like, you know, took me a couple games, but I feel like, you know, I adapted pretty quick. And yeah, I would say the difference with year two is, you know, coming into year two, I knew the team, I knew the league, I knew the, you know, the pro life, if you want to say it like that. So yeah, I was also much more confident, you know, having a season under my belt. I was way better. I was faster. I was stronger. I was bigger. I was just better overall. I had more experience. So I feel like, you know, I just improved way too much across the board.
Do you feel like New Zealand put the ball in your hands more? Was there more responsibility for you in that second year?
Yeah, I would say I got the ball a bit more in the second year.
Yeah, I mean, I think the connective ability, like the playmaking you showed off a little bit more in year two, which is probably part of the appeal for you at the NBA. You're not necessarily, you know, going to have the ball in your hands every possession, like a Luka type. You're not that, but you are a guy, I just feel like, who can, as we talked about earlier, that block you had on Kessler, can bring the ball up the floor yourself. You can run a pick and roll. You can set a screen and operate out of the short roll. You can post up with your back to the basket or face up. You can be used as a guy who attacks a closeout from the corner and makes an accurate kick out passes. I feel like that the connective ability, when I talk to NBA teams, is one of the more appealing qualities about you on the offensive end of the floor.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, something I've always been good at, you know, developing throughout the years. I've been, you know, I had the opportunity to show it a little bit more this last year than the first one. I would say, you know, also a lot of other stuff that I haven't, you know, maybe fully shown or shown, you know, maybe I've shown flashes, but I haven't, you know, consistently, you know, shown, but that I know I can do and that I know I will do at the NBA level as years go by and I improve. So yeah, you know, there's, you know, you got, I don't think you guys have seen it all. Definitely not.
Now I'm curious about that because, I mean, like in the Next Stars program, there's been, you know, three top 10 guys, LaMelo Ball, Josh Giddey, Alex Saar, and there's been a number of highly productive offensive players. I think you've been one of, if not the most productive two-way guy, overall player over two ways. You were the youngest player in NBL history to record a double-double. That happened in October 2024. You had a career-high 32 points in January 2026, earlier this year. And in that game, you showed off a a diverse ability as a scorer. I remember in the second half of that game, late in the game, you had this almost kind of like a Dirk one-footed fadeaway right around the free throw line area, and you hit a three early in the game, did a lot off the dribble. Is that what you mean when you say showing off more is kind of that offensive skill set as a scorer?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I feel like I said, I showed it in flashes. Like that game, for example, you know, I had the ball in my hands, had to, you know, create more. And it's something I'm comfortable doing. You know, it's something I really feel good about, you know, in my abilities to do that. And yeah, you know, like that Dirk-esque fadeaway, if you can call it like that. I feel like it's something that I'm a shot that I'm pretty good at. That I've always been pretty good at, you know, but yeah, I'll continue to show it more, you know, show more of my, you know, skills and my talent.
What is your biggest area of improvement on the offensive end of the floor?
I would say on the offensive end, you said?
Yeah, on the offensive end.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm working on everything, right, in this pre-draft process, but, you know, I would say my shot consistency. You know, I'm a really confident shooter, and I think, you know, if you watch the film, you can see it. You know, the shots I was taking, I was not hesitant at all. You know, I was letting it fly, even from, you know, behind the arc, you know, a couple feet back, or, you know, even with a contest. You know, I'm really confident as a shooter, but I feel like, you know, I had stretches where I was really good, and I had stretches where I was not so good, right? So, you know, getting that consistency up, I feel like it'll elevate my game for sure.
You hit 33% of your catch and shoot threes these past 2 years in the NBL. Were you more of a non-shooter at younger levels, and you're like still growing into what you will become as a shooter? I guess I'm curious about the history of your development as a shooter. Were you once a guy that didn't shoot much at all?
Not really. I've always shot threes. I've always taken them. I've always been super confident in that. I feel like, you know, before coming to New Zealand, you know, I was playing in Spain, the U18s, also a little bit with the ACB team. Yeah, I feel like, you know, especially in the youth program, I was really, you know, I was shooting pretty good, you know, different types, catch and shoot, off the dribble, you know, step backs, different types of things. Then, you know, the adjustment, you know, you go into the NBL, it's different. You know, you're going against better defense, right? Better defense. The game just is quicker. You know, it's different. So it took me a little bit to adapt. I feel like, you know, especially at the start of my first year, I was, you know, I was breaking a lot. Let's say it like that. But I feel like, you know, it will, you know, that will come. I'm super confident in that. I'll be a super high level shooter. So yeah, I'm really confident in that.
I've heard, you know, there's been like a lot of group workouts, it seems like. Do you have any upcoming that you're looking to prove yourself against other, you know, players in a similar range as you?
Yeah, well, I haven't had any of these group workouts, but I'll be having a couple soon. You know, I'm going to Brooklyn in a couple of days. Going up against Nate Amend. I think that's who's going to be in that workout. Super excited for that. I feel like it's going to be a good one. I'm excited for that.
The improvements you've made, I'm curious, we talked about your offense on defense. You show ability sometimes to be a lockdown on-ball guy. You show ability to be an effective help defender. We talked about that Kessler block and of many plays. Obviously, you've had a lot of success as a weak side rim protector coming in for blocks and all that. One of the criticisms I've heard of you sometimes is that occasionally you can get a little, you know, spacey, a little aloof off the ball. Sometimes you can be a little late with rotations. What needs to happen for you to become like A+ in that category? Well, how do you close that gap?
Yeah, I think those things, one, also come with experience. Also, you know, I mean, I've been watching a lot of film, you know, even throughout the season. I feel like you can see the improvements from the start to the end. You know, I feel like at the start I was definitely a bit more, you know, kind of, you can say, maybe spaced out on the off ball actions, or, you know, on rotations, I was a bit worse. But then, you know, I would say at the end, you know, I worked a lot on it, you know, with the team, with the coaches, extra work, watching a lot of film. I think those are things that, you know, those are the things that you got to do. You know, just, I mean, it'll come with playing, it'll come with watching a lot of film, improving, working on that. But I think I've made pretty good progress in that.
How much have you watched the playoffs this year?
A good amount.
I mean, obviously, you're busy with workouts and training and everything like that. So I am curious, though, like, what stood out to you from watching the playoffs? What have your observations been?
Yeah, well, I would say the physicality, you know, of the game, the pace that has been played out. It's just been, you know, really fast game, really physical game, you know. The size, I think all those three things I'm really good at, and I can provide to any team. You know, my size, my physicality, my ability, you know, to play, you know, fast and play in transition. Also, you know, it's about making the quick reads, right? It's about making quick decisions. You know, you don't have the time to, you know, think about it. You don't have time to waste, right? And I feel like I'm a high IQ player, and I feel like, you know, those are the things I really can provide them to any team.
I mean, I think you're spot on about that. Like, the physicality, I feel like everybody's mentioning, but I think the quick decisions you're talking about as well, I mean, they kind of go hand in hand. If you're playing a physical game where you're able to bump and push you off your spots, you need to react quickly and adapt and come up with a backup plan to if your plan A and your plan B aren't working. I think that's like the players that are getting minutes and playing effective in minutes are able to be physical, and they're smart. I mean, it's like if those two qualities, it's kind of hard to get those heavy minutes right now in the as the deeper it goes into the postseason, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, that's something that's going to help me. I feel like I'm already, you know, really good at that. And I feel like, you know, I feel like I could be plugged into any team right now in the playoffs and, you know, help them and, you know, play a role and, you know, help the team win.
I have some random questions for you, Kareem. Starting with number one, what's your biggest motivator?
My biggest motivator, I would say I have a lot, honestly. You know, first off, you know, myself, you know, I want to, you know, make this dream a reality. You know, it motivates me to, you know, step into my, you know, be so close to my goals and, you know, all the work I put in. It really motivates me to keep going and to show myself that I'm capable and show everybody that, you know, that I belong. Also, it motivates me, you know, to do it for my family. You know, they really believe in me. They're always supporting me, always been with me. You know, so it motivates me, you know, to, you know, show them that I was, you know, that I was right. That I wasn't crazy to think I was going to make the NBA at 10 years old, right? And also, you know, it motivates me just to go into the best league in the world and, you know, go up against the best players, compete, and just live the dream, right? It's something I'm really excited about.
You mentioned the NBA at 10 years old. Who was your favorite player at that time? In like, what, 2017, you were 10, something like that?
Yeah. LeBron.
Okay, LeBron. So you probably love those Cavs teams, right? You grew up with him making the finals every year through when you were a baby all the way through being a toddler and a child.
Literally,
you missed,
man,
a lot of it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, man, literally, I was like two nights ago, I was watching, I was rewatching some of that 2018 LeBron playoff run. And I was like, wow, like, this is just insane.
I mean, assuming he doesn't retire, you'll be entering the league with him still in it. It's kind of crazy, right?
it is crazy. You know, I feel like growing up, I didn't really think about that because, like, you know, he's, I mean, he's, what, is he the oldest player in the league? Yeah, he is, right?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
He is the oldest player in the league. He's still playing at this high of a level. It's just insane. Something I've never seen before. I think I would have never thought, you know, about the possibility of going up against a, what, 42-year-old LeBron James, 43-year-old LeBron James. But, I mean, hey, it's the possibility is there. I hope he doesn't retire.
No, I'm with you there. I hope we get more LeBron. He's still a great player, even great at this player. Phase of his career, as hard as that is to believe. All right, next random question for you. What's your biggest pet peeve?
What does that mean? I feel like I've heard that before.
Peeves, yeah, something that annoys you, like bugs you.
In basketball?
Anything. Life or basketball.
Something that annoys me. Something that annoys me is when people don't put all their effort into something they're doing, you know, and, you know, you're just going through the motions or, you know, not working hard. And it doesn't have to be in basketball, right? But in anything you're doing that you really want to do, if you're going to do something, do it right, right? Or at least put in your best effort, you know, into doing it. So if you're not doing it, why are you even doing it in the first place, right?
All right, next up, what's some music you like that might surprise some people?
That might surprise some people? I mean, Bad Bunny would have surprised anybody because, right? So I would say I listen to some French music and Brazilian music.
Okay, that's cool. Do you speak those languages at all, or is it just the vibes, the melodies?
I don't speak those languages at all. I know a couple words, but it's just the vibes, man. You should listen to it. It's pretty good.
Who's an artist I should check out, or a song?
Man, I'm bad with the names. There's a song. It's called Seya, S-E-Y-A. It's from French artist and a Spanish artist too, but the French part is pretty good. Awesome.
I'll check that out after this. Seya, I see, by G-I-M-S. I'll check that out, whoever that is. All right, next up, what do you do besides basketball? What are your non-basketball interests?
In New Zealand, I was living really close to the beach, like 5 minutes away. So I would spend some time in there. It was really cool. I like to spend time with my family, spend time with my friends. Probably same as everybody. I play some video games. I'm starting to learn how to cook because I cannot cook at all. So, you know, I'm interested in that. I'm starting to learn how to cook. I know how to cut hair a little bit. So, yeah, those are some of the things.
What do you love most about basketball?
It's just fun. It's just, you know, it's what I love to do. I started playing the game because it was fun. I didn't start playing the game because anything else, right? I started playing the game because it was something that made me happy. And it's still, you know, to this day, it's a really fun thing to do. And it's just what makes me happy, what I love to do.
Well, Kareem, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode, man. Wishing you the best, rooting for you, and enjoy this whole process. Looking forward to seeing the way it all unfolds. Thank you, man.
Sir, appreciate it, man.
Big thank you to S. Barahini and Kareem Lopez for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the whole crew at Yahoo Sports in New York City for helping produce today's episode. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again either later tonight or early tomorrow on Wednesday with another finals podcast with a very special guest that I'm excited about. Have a good rest of your day.